Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming. And may I begin with apologizing because there's several people who got in touch with me, and I told everyone that it was happening in the Vera Anstey room. But if they're there, then they can't hear this, but I still thought I'd begin with an apology. I did check. There was no one there just now, but really sorry, but I did actually send the message because there was some confusion with the room bookings, as is usual. Thank you very much. We're delighted to welcome Professor David Gilmartin. We at the South Asia Center, my name is Nilanjan Sarkar. I'm Deputy Director of the South Asia Center, and I speak also on behalf of my director, Dr. Mukulika Banerjee, who is unable to be here this evening. She's flying from India at the moment. We at the South Asia Center are especially delighted to welcome Professor David Gilmartin, not least because this is the second time in 1 year that he has accepted our invitation. In April this year, we had the Pakistan at 70 conference in Karachi, where Professor Gilmartin spoke on his new book, and he spoke on the Indus and its people, the river basin, and the imagining of Pakistan. This evening, he will speak on Pakistan and the grand narratives of 20th century history. I did ask him just now whether he wanted to change the title. There was still time. He said no, it was still the same title, but the narrative was probably not as grand as when we had decided this sometime in July or something. I'm not going to speak for very long, but I did think that what I wanted to say is that this has been a fantastic year, doing a series of events to mark 70 years of independence in the subcontinent of Pakistan, of India, and we had a very good exhibition on the constitutions of Pakistan in the atrium for a month. There's one on India going on at the moment. And these lectures are in many ways a continuation of something that we started last year called Colony as Empire, where what we were trying to do at the South Asia Center was to create a new series of lectures which looked at the role of the colony and the emergence of the colony within the history of the empire. There is a very interesting exhibition that is on at the library at the moment, which also deals called Paths to Freedom or Roads to Independence or something like that. We're going to do a guided tour of that after this lecture. You're very welcome to come. There's a reception as well, if that is more tempting. Professor David Gilmartin is currently Distinguished Professor of History at the Department of History, North Carolina State University. And the only thing I would say, apart from mentioning his latest book, which is called Blood and Water, The Indus River Basin in Modern History, which was published in 2015, and is now considered one of the most important contributions of a book that is at the crossroads of history and environmental history. Would you just like to come in and sit somewhere? Find a seat. But for several of you in this room, I know, the other book that we all remember Professor Gilmartin for is Empire in Islam, Punjab and the Making of Pakistan, which was published in 1988, also from the University of California Press. Without further ado, Professor Gilmartin will now speak for about 45 to 50 minutes. We'll then have a Q&A. We have to vacate this room at 8 o'clock. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Nilanjan, and thanks also to Mukulika Banerjee, who, as Nilanjan said, unfortunately can't be here tonight, but I appreciate very much the invitation, and I look forward to your comments and questions. As Nilanjan said, he had asked me for a title for a talk on the 70th anniversary of Pakistan, and so I think it must have been late at night I came up with this one, which I think is a very nice idea for a talk. But unfortunately, as I tried to think about this, it was quite clear that figuring out the grand narratives of 20th century history would itself be a full-time undertaking. So I'm not going to really try to put Pakistan into a whole series of different narratives, including the narrative of environmental history, which I'm very interested in. But rather, I want to start out with a question which has struck me for some time, and it relates to this question, and that is that Pakistan has a very strange place, actually, in the narratives of decolonization and of new nations in the 20th century. So, I mean, if you pick up books that on decolonization, and there's been a huge amount of writing on this in recent years, it's not that the creation of Pakistan is in any way ignored, because it will appear in all these accounts, but historians, generally speaking, don't know exactly what to do with it. And there are a couple big reasons for this. One of them has to do with the very close connection between the independence of India and the creation of Pakistan. So Pakistan, as I'll discuss in a bit, was undoubtedly a movement with a very strong vision of a nation that lay behind it, but in some ways, this was a story that was as much about separation from India as it was about the creation of a new country. So it therefore appears as a kind of, you know, footnote. It doesn't quite fit. Here's a place where the nation sort of failed, because India didn't emerge as a unified nation, and of course Pakistan emerged out of this conflict with India. So that's one reason, and one could say partition itself, of course, came out of that, and that's another footnote, usually a kind of lamenting footnote about the partitions that marked the history of British imperialism. So Pakistan's creation is often linked with the partition of Ireland and the partition of Palestine. And these are all sort of problematic stories in that history. So that's one reason. But the second reason is much more basic, and I think this is what I'd like to focus on a bit. It has to do with the problem of how historians think about religion and its relationship to nationalism. And there's been a considerable amount of historical writing which has very much tended to see religion and modern nationalism as sort of antithetical types of movements. So, I mean, the classic example of this, which is still influential, is the book by Benedict Anderson on imagined communities, which is probably the most influential book of the last 50 years about nationalism. And Benedict Anderson, while he sees a lot of interconnections between religion and nationalism, nevertheless has a basic narrative in which nationalism succeeds religion. It takes over some of the loyalties from religion, but ultimately these are fundamentally different things. And so all of this, you know, sort of raises problems for how we think about Pakistan. So what I would like to do is give a slightly different narrative of the creation of Pakistan, trying to actually avoid saying too much about religion as a part of this story. And what I would like to do is to instead talk a lot about the concept of sovereignty. And I'll say more in a second about exactly what I mean by sovereignty, because it also is a term about which there's been all kinds of debate. But I want to go back to the structure of British rule in India and think about the nature of sovereignty that defined the British Raj, and then think about how both Pakistan and India attempted to assert a new vision of sovereignty, which drew on that British model, but also challenged it at the same time. So I want to think about sovereignty, and my hope in doing this is that focusing on sovereignty may allow us to maybe move away from the idea of religion, which I think actually is quite problematic in thinking about the history of Pakistan's creation. But I want to link that to another critical element, which, as I'll argue in a second, is central to the projection of sovereignty by the British in India, as I'll say in a second, though one needs some caveats on this. But that is the idea of the rule of law as a foundation for sovereign authority. And in fact, my argument would be this has a fundamental role in shaping what happens with the creation of Pakistan. And I'd like to just, before I get into a discussion of this, just read a short quote from a recent book by Shahab Ahmed called What is Islam?, which is a sweeping critique of the way modern religious specialists in academia and historians have actually dealt with the history of Islam. And his fundamental argument, he makes many arguments, but one of his fundamental arguments has to do with the problem of law and the understandings of law that have shaped Muslim ideas. And his the reason for this is because he argues that law is absolutely at the heart of the movement of modern nationalism and the development of nation states. So just a brief quote from Shahab Ahmed. Law, he says, is a leitmotif of the modern human condition in a manner and degree unprecedented in any prior period of history. Not only is the fundamental organizational unit of modern human society to which all human subjects belong, that is, the nation state, not only is that constituted as a, and here he emphasizes this, legally determined entity as distinct from a divinely or patrimonially determined entity, but one might even say that the nation state is a great legal fiction literally made up by law. The modern human condition is more thoroughly pervaded by the technology and force of the structures of law than has been any other human condition. And what I would like to say and to suggest is that this law was central to the imagining and the creation of Pakistan as well, but in a way which has not often been focused on. So that's what I would like to do. So let me begin by going back to the question of sovereignty and what that is, and then I want to link this to the idea of law and the rule of law as a form of sovereignty, and then I want to discuss how that provided the framework in which Indians of many different types challenged British rule, and this involves not just Muslims and not just the movement for Pakistan, but then look at how the particular form of the Pakistan movement grew out of that particular situation. So what do I mean by sovereignty? So sovereignty, of course, is as I said a moment ago, is a much argued term, and some people think it's so difficult to define it might be simply put to bed. But my view is it's quite central. And the reason it's central is that, in my view, what sovereignty is all about, and here there are a number of thinkers who argue this, is what the critical element in sovereignty is that it is the basic foundation for legitimation of authority. So when I'm talking about sovereignty, I'm talking about the grounds on which a state asserts its right to rule. And the interesting thing about the concept of sovereignty is it has both a very practical, power-oriented side to it and a side which takes one outside the normal realms of politics. So for a state to be sovereign, it has to do two things simultaneously. First, it has to mobilize power to maintain order in society and make its writ run through society. So sovereignty involves structures of power, structures of political manipulation. It involves the ability of a state to actually create a social order. So that's one side of it. But on the other side, it also involves claims by a state to tap into forms of power and forms of authority that exist outside the normal realms of social and political organization and social power. So on that level, sovereignty is about what some people have called the enchantment of power. That is, the way that power is imagined to convey an authority that transcends its own operation. So one can track this historically through all kinds of context in South Asia and elsewhere. But as an example of this, I would like to just make brief reference to Özvür Moin's recent book about the Mughals, which was called Millennial Sovereignty. And what Moin does in that book is very much emphasize the way the Mughals, going back to the time of the Emperor Akbar, but even a bit earlier than that, laid claim to power through two means, one being the establishment of a very pragmatic structure of rule that involved a more elaborate bureaucracy than states had previously managed to construct in South Asia, but two involved laying claim to a kind of power that existed outside society. So the clearest example of this lies in the appeal of the Emperor Akbar to manifest a dynastic, what his Abul Fazl, his propagandist, called a divine light that passed through Mughal genealogy. And as Özvür Moin argues, this was part of a large vision of how power operated in the world that existed during the post-Mongol period in South Asia and in Central Asia. So he sees it as shared with the Safavids, extending over a broad geographical area. So, and he also argues that this vision of power coming from outside, coming from hidden realms, that enchanted the authority of the Mughal emperors, was every bit as much importance to their power as were their direct administrative arrangements, and it was linked to society as a whole. So here again, a statement of this. This is from Niall Green's book about Sufis. He says, and this is writing about this period, Sufi and political texts did not so much borrow from one another's distinct spheres, but were rather both part of a wider literary and cultural ecumene in which kings and saints shared center stage together. And they share center stage together because they both claim a certain kind of enchantment through their ability to draw on this hidden world of forces that existed. And the key thing here is these were manifested in special individuals through primarily genealogy at that time. So this is important to talk about. I mean, in Pakistan today, of course, there are many narratives that take the history of Pakistan back to the Mughals, but this is not my argument. My argument is simply that there was a similarity in forms of sovereignty one can track back to the Mughals, and you find a different but yet similar in its basic structure form of sovereignty being asserted by the British. And the British, here again, there's some argument in the literature as to the exact forms of sovereign authority that the British projected when they ruled, and these were clearly contested and developed over time. But particularly from post-1858 onward, after the Great Revolt of 1857, there is a much clearer coalescence within British thinking about this idea that ultimately British authority rested on something that the British called the rule of law. And I want to just first, so you get this out of your mind, when I say rule of law, this is not about how everyday law operated in India. It's about the underlying notion of sovereign authority that underlay a British claim to be operating according to the rule of law. And this delineation of the rule of law as a sovereign force was discussed by quite a number of people, but probably the most interesting was James Fitzjames Stephen, who was the law member of the Viceroy's council, and who put this very clearly, argued that ultimately British authority came from law. But then he went on to say, this is from the 1870s, quote, "The establishment of a system of law," Stephen said, "in itself constitutes a moral conquest more striking, more durable, and far more solid than the physical context which rendered it possible. It exercises an influence over the minds of people in many ways comparable to that of a new religion." So what does that mean, comparing the rule of law to a religion? And what I would argue is that what he's getting at, one shouldn't take that too seriously, but what he's arguing is that the rule of law represents a kind of enchantment of authority in the sense we were talking about Mughal authority. That is, the carriers of power have a kind of enchanted claim to sovereignty. But for the British, this was not rooted in divine genealogy. It was rather rooted in a certain vision, going back to the 18th century, of a detached, self-controlled persona that allowed them to set aside, in theory, everyday political interests in the name of a kind of detached notion of law. And here I'm drawing on the work of Mithi Mukherjee, who has written I think, probably the best book out there as of now on sovereignty under the British. And she very much argues this, that the British vision of power, though she's not so concerned with sovereignty per se, but the British vision of power was very much one which involved what she called a notion of justice as equity, meaning as fairness. That is, without particular substantive content, but simply lying in the notion that the British as judges stood apart from Indian society, were detached from Indian society, and therefore could order it. And what links that to a kind of sovereign enchantment is it's a vision of the self. It's a notion about how a certain type of self-controlled detachment can convey this sort of sovereign authority. So in this sense, it in fact resonated with large numbers of Indians, I might add, particularly upper class, upper caste Indians, particularly with Brahmins, but hardly exclusively, because it involved a kind of sovereign power associated with a certain type of asceticism, that is, control over oneself, which yielded a certain kind of power. So this of course, again, when this is put in these kinds of terms, one can easily say, you know, well, what did this have to do with the way the British actually ruled, which was filled with violence and all kinds of oppression? But one could say the same about the Mughals. This was a kind of vision of enchanted sovereign authority, which in fact caught the imaginations of lots of Indians. So how did this create a particular structure of rule? And this is important in getting toward the kind of backdrop that comes with the creation of Pakistan. So the law itself was structured in a way to maintain this, and there was contained in this a certain vision of the people and what the people of India were. So again, there's been a lot of writing on this. The basic structure of the law in India involved the British emphasizing a strong distinction between the procedure of law and the substance of law, so that there was a separate Hindu law, a separate Muslim law, in some parts of India, customary law, but ultimately there was one procedure that came from British law. And procedure was the highest expression of this kind of self-controlled, ascetic, self-binding to rules, so that you would, well, okay, great, I will rule on whatever substance is brought before me. It was the procedure which was the foundation of this. So what the British created in this was this vision in which there was an Indian people, but the people themselves were defined by a kind of substance-based law which was separated from procedure. And the word that really captured this under the British Raj was the word custom. That people in India had their customs. And in fact, religion itself was transformed into something that looked very much like custom. That is, it was things people did. It was a product of their past. It was a product of their social relations. But it was separated from procedure, which was an expression of reason and self-control and ascetic power. And so this structure in some ways actually
created a structure in which Indian culture had a powerful place in this system, and it created a system of rights, customary rights, whereby people could assert their claims against the British, and the British would say, fine. So religion was recognized, and a culture was recognized as authentic and providing rightful claims. And we can find a lot of examples where these claims were made against the state itself. And this, which one thinks of as a classic kind of notion of the rule of law. And these claims could successfully be made if it was proved that these were customary claims. But the key point is this system excluded those who followed custom, whose culture could be defined simply as custom, whose religion could be defined as really just nothing but custom. This separated them from claims to sovereignty. Sovereignty lay on the side of procedure. This was the realm of the enchanted power. And this is explicitly stated by a number of British thinkers, but just to give one here, this is a quote from John Stuart Mill in the middle of the 19th century, who says this very clearly. Customs are fine. Customs are great. But, quote, though the customs be both good as customs and suitable to people, yet to conform to custom merely as custom does not educate or develop in him, that is, in an individual person, any of the qualities which are the distinctive endowments of being a full human being. I mean, this is classic Mill. The human faculties of perception, judgment, discriminative feeling, mental activity, even moral preference are exercised only in making choices. He who does anything because it is custom makes no choice. And this is the way religion was projected under the British. So I give this background as a kind of way to create the framework for thinking about the demands for new nations that came in the 20th century, although they have roots even before that. Because the challenge is not to get recognition for the authenticity of Indian culture, which has already been recognized. The problem is to lay claim to sovereign authority. And that means breaking through this distinction where religion is just about what people have always done, about customary practice. And so this is quite clear-cut in the way the British treated, for example, the development of Islamic law, which was recognized as having its own coherence, its own authenticity, its own importance, but it did not lay any claim to sovereign authority because it was all a matter of following, as the British saw it, as following in the name of what had been laid down before. So the people were divorced from sovereignty. The key was to actually, as I said, break through this. So in the 20th century, and here finally we'll get to some discussion about Pakistan. In the 20th century, you can see a number of very powerful movements that did precisely this. And one of them, the best known, the most powerful, of course, is associated with Mahatma Gandhi, who precisely was concerned to attack the British by asserting that there was, in fact, a higher law than that brought by the British. So Gandhi was himself, of course, deeply influenced by British ideas about the rule of law. But he also, as he began to organize the politics in India after he returned from South Africa, Gandhi came to be scathing about how the system of British law actually worked in India. So, you know, he said that Indians who had participated in the legal system, lawyers, were complicit in enslaving India. And the point was that they were complicit because of this structure that the British had brought. So what had to be done was a higher claim had to be made about a law and personal law of self-control commitment that challenged the British themselves. And of course, this is exactly what Gandhi did as he organized Satyagraha. That is, he took the idea of the rule of law as a foundation to actually attack the way the British administered it in India. And this had a huge mobilizing power. And I might add, there were many Muslims who were attracted to this as well. However, the position of the Muslim community as a distinctive entity came to be encapsulated within this system by the very reforms that the British instituted in response to Gandhi. So here I want to just say a word about the introduction of elections. Elections were introduced in there were some earlier elections, but as an important element in the British system were introduced in the 1919 reforms. And though it was a limited franchise, nevertheless, the elections were quite important in bringing new groups into the system. Critical to elections, they were in some fundamental ways built on a challenge to the way the British themselves had previously asserted their sovereignty. That is, people were given the right to make choices. And in fact, this was reflected in the law of elections that the British introduced. And this was a subject of a lot of controversy. And what drove this was the British need to get legitimacy both back home and in the international arena. So they did introduce a law which protected the right of individuals to make choices. It represented a challenge. However, at the very same time, elections also maintained this same structure that they had before. That is, and here I want to talk particularly about separate electorates for Muslims. Separate electorates were not simply a British idea because there was a fair amount of Muslim support for them. But nevertheless, separate electorates for Muslims were, in some parts of India, were introduced earlier, but they became much more general after 1919. It was only then that they were introduced into the Punjab, for example. Separate electorates represented a continuation of the same structure of sovereignty and of the rule of law that we talked about earlier. That is, Muslims as a community were encapsulated in their own constituencies. Islam had nothing to do with the procedure of elections. It was in the legal procedures of elections, the protection of individual voters, that elections challenged the British system. Separate electorates did nothing to do this. In fact, separate electorates powerfully reinstated the same vision of the Muslim community as basically a non-sovereign community, one locked into custom, not into personal transformation. And this this became a subject of some controversy within elections in the 1920s, for example. Some Muslims sort of challenged the definition of Muslim community that was built into these elections, which was just a census definition. No notion of individual enchantment in being a Muslim and voting in a separate electorate. And so I've looked at some of these cases. In one case in the 1920s in the Punjab, there was a challenge as to whether Ahmadis should be allowed to vote and whether they should be allowed to stand for election. And this was, in a sense, an attempt, you know, for wherever this led down the line, which is something that we could talk more about. But at that point, what this was to give a kind of choice to being a Muslim. That not just everybody who is in the census is a Muslim is an equal Muslim. That the election itself is part of this. But what happened was, I mean, within the structure of British rule in elections, this got almost no traction. It was reflected in popular movements. It was reflected in protests. And here it's not just questions about Ahmadis, but many questions developed that mobilized Muslims. But these were generally did not gain any traction significantly within the actual structure of procedure and substance that shaped elections themselves. So what these separate electorates really led to was what some historians have called the minoritization of Muslims. So what does that term mean, minoritization? So what I would like to suggest is minoritization, I mean, yes, it has this root in a kind of numerical calculation, but that's not where its power comes. Minoritization means exclusion from sovereign claims. What it means is a community who is minoritized. Yes, we can have safeguards, protections, but to say that there's a minority is to say a group does not share in sovereign claims. And interestingly enough, of course, the Congress itself by the 1930s had very much taken up this same position. So when you get to the Muslim mass contacts program in the Congress after the 1937 elections, you know, Nehru and these people say, yes, of course, Muslims can participate in the Congress, be part of the nationalist movement, but not as Muslims, as individuals. Then they have a claim to sovereignty as well, but not as Muslims. And so this creates this tension that defines the what ultimately comes to be the Pakistan movement. And what I would like to argue is that the real driving force in the Pakistan movement, the claim for Pakistan, is really understandable not in terms of religion per se, but in terms of sovereignty, in terms of a claim to actually have sovereign authority. And that's what this Pakistan state comes to symbolize. And this is not a state that comes into being simply because people are Muslims. The entire rhetoric of Pakistan is built around making choices. That this is a choice that people can make. And if you look at I've looked at some of the election material from the 1946 elections, particularly in the Punjab, and there's this clear link between support for Pakistan and the idea that One is asserting a kind of what I would call sovereign self, that is, making a choice, that this is strongly emphasized in the context. It's a matter of conscience. And it's in sharp contrast to the vision that's involved in the Muslim community. But the interesting thing about this, so this is very deeply embedded in this sovereignty of the rule of law. Pakistan is absolutely rooted in that tradition. But the relationship of this to Islamic law remains extremely ambivalent and ambiguous. Because here's what's interesting about the movement for Pakistan is that on the one hand it asserts this notion of choice, and this is often tied to a long history of Muslim development. So, I mean, Iqbal, for example, strongly makes these arguments about how this demand is rooted in a long history of dynamism and personal choice and a sense of self, you know, hudi, of a real sense of personhood, which is very much like the old rule of law tradition. But this is very much a kind of attack at the very same time on the sort of mass of the Muslim community, who is seen as embedded in this old vision, customary vision of Islam. And so for people like Iqbal and others as well, take Islamic law, take the Sharia as a kind of symbol of dynamism and treat it that way, at the very same time that they have relatively little use for Islamic law as it's actually practiced by the ulama or in the British courts, for that matter, either through Anglo-Mohammedan law. So this sharp dichotomy, rule of law requires a law, so to be sovereign, Muslims must have their own law, and this is the Sharia. But this is virtually disconnected from the actual way that law operated. And this goes back to Shahab Ahmed's point, that this vision of law as the ulama practiced it as being central to the history of Islam is in a completely different world from what you find in this argument. So this leads to this irony, and this is what I would like to conclude with about Pakistan, where Pakistan, interestingly enough, it's created both as a state which represents a particular vision of personal transformation tied to the history of Islam and Islamic dynamism, on the one hand, and on the other hand, in fact, is an attack on Islam, is an attack on the nature of the system that, in fact, created it. And this explains a lot of, I mean, there's been a lot of work on Pakistan, for those of you familiar with this, know full well, who have argued that, you know, this can be seen. So Naveeda Khan has written about how Pakistan had to be seen as an aspiration, that's the only way to make sense of this. Or Faisal Deveji's book on Muslim Zion talks about this vision of Pakistan as being disconnected from the actual Muslim community as it existed at this time. And I think we can only understand that if we set aside the idea of religion and think about this as a struggle for sovereignty, and particularly about its connection to the rule of law. And in that context, I think the story of Pakistan actually is a really interesting one for 20th century history. That these are not peculiar conflicts in Pakistan, although they take a very acute form. But we can see these themes, the question of the working out of the rule of law and the question of the sovereignty of the people, as being some of the central themes of 20th century history. And if we put Pakistan more into that context, I think that we could begin to see histories that would, of the 20th century, in which Pakistan would have a much more important place than, you know, simply as a geopolitical problem and a place where terrorists live. So I would like to stop there, and I'd be very interested in any questions or comments.
Would you like to sit here and take questions from here?
Well, where I could stand, that's fine.
I mean, you're a sovereign entity.
I'll choose to stand.
Questions, comments? I don't want to be the first one to ask. Professor Fuller.
It's a very persuasive argument, David. But surely there's a fundamental difference between the kind of concepts of legality and sovereignty which would have existed in West Pakistan from East Pakistan. That, I mean, Punjab is non-regulation province in which customary law was supposed to have a great importance, whereas, of course, Bengal was an old regulation province where customary law had much less importance. I mean, not in relation to family structures and so on, but in terms of land tenure and rights to economic well-being and so on. So wouldn't you therefore expect that the, say, the average Punjabi to have a fundamentally different idea of what legal sovereignty would be from the average Bengali? And wouldn't that complicate your story greatly about Pakistan's emergence on the basis of some idea of legal sovereignty?
Yeah, no. It would complicate it. I agree with you completely. I mean, you clearly, an argument like this, you would need to be more firmly grounded. But the one thing I would say is that again, I think this rule of law as an ideology of imperial rule operated every bit as much in Bengal as it did in the West. And that's why I said it should be separated from the specificities of revenue policy and, you know, whether you have the permanent settlement or whether you have, you know, village settlements and things like this, which are certainly important in, as are a whole range of popular practices and ideas. So I wouldn't like to play that down. But I would like to say I do think there is a significant commonality between Bengal and Punjab in this, and it is reflected in the terms in which Pakistan is projected, where, yes, there are differences, but there are also lots of similarities. And I think this attempt to kind of break out of a structure where people, as I said, which recognizes the authenticity of culture but denies its sovereignty, is common to both sides. So that's kind of what I was looking for.
Yes, please.
On the same way, I would like to suggest that if you'd... So I've been looking at some of the Indian law reports which have been published since 1862.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if the more time you spend in them, you realize that the way you've understood custom is problematic fundamentally, because the way the law reports at least suggest is that the practice of law seems to have an understanding where it's almost in line with Matthew Nelson's approach to Islam versus custom, where Sharia is at some times in legal cases comes in the favor of an inheritance claim from a woman, for example. And custom is understood outside Sharia as practice which is being practiced on, you know, from the primogeniture terms, inheritance on based on primogeniture terms in Punjab especially. So I just would like to suggest that the idea of custom would get much complicated if you ground your analysis on law reports and a critical legal studies approach, perhaps.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with you at all on that, but I would say, you're absolutely right, and I have read lots of these reports, and what's interesting, of course, is that it's not just that custom and Sharia are projected as different categories and often in tension, but when these British judges claim to in fact be simply applying British legal procedure, that all kinds of ideas creep into the way they interpret this. So I'm thinking about Rachel Sturman's book about Bombay, where you know, ostensibly they're not supposed to allow contemporary British ideas to influence the procedure, which is laid out very clearly, but in fact they do. So it is more complicated in practice. But the main point I would make is that though what's called customary law and custom is distinct from Sharia, and you see this in the courts, and certainly you see it in the ulama, who themselves are attacking custom all the time. But nevertheless, the religious law, Sharia, is really not ever taken seriously by the British as a kind of sovereign law. It is a different thing. And it's really, and you can find this even in these cases, that it's really viewed as a form of custom. That is, you know, it's completely bound into the past. You know, and it's interesting, the British even use some of the same terminology, you know, like custom shouldn't change. That custom changing is kind of like an oxymoron. Well, yes, it changes sometimes, but it's in the nature of custom. And they argue about this all the time. But it's like bid'ah, you know, it's like you're supposed to not change. And if you do, you undermine custom. And this shows up in these cases as well. So I would like to, push back a little bit and suggest the way the British viewed religion in India was very much as if it were fundamentally custom.
I'm really intrigued by the connection that you made between sovereignty and choice. But I think it becomes troublesome in the context of Kashmir, which for me, and I'm interested in knowing on how you, through this lens of choice and sovereignty, which are linked, to look at the context of Kashmir, where for me, I think that the choice of self-determination and as well as religious identity have both failed.
Have failed, you see. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, I'm no expert on Kashmir, but I think that's probably a very accurate statement. I mean, so is there a legitimate sovereign authority in Kashmir? And whether you're, you know, talking about Azad Kashmir or whether you're talking about Indian Kashmir, I mean, this is a very contested thing. And so I don't think it challenges the larger argument per se, but it's clearly a case where sovereignty has, it's the great exception, you know. You, and this goes back to something I said about sovereignty, which I think is quite important, is that sovereignty is about enchanted authority. That is, that has this kind of legitimacy, which is linked to, you know, whether it be reason or whether it be, you know, unseen forces in the cosmos, but it's also linked to the pragmatic questions about maintaining order, and at times these absolutely can displace everything, and Kashmir would be a case of that. Yeah.
Yes, please.
Yeah.
Don't know whether it's a comment or a question.
Okay. Yeah.
The other point, the other question is, what parallels can you draw between the desire for sovereign state and the desire to civilize other countries, wherever that draw might come from? But I think sovereignty is being sort of a Western concept that's kind of traveled east rather than something that's coming out of different parts of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, so just I'll come back to Iran in a second, but to take the second part first, this is part of the big debate on sovereignty, which, and I didn't go into any of the details on this, but there are people who say this. I mean, the point you've made is one you'll find in the literature also, who say sovereignty is, in fact, a European concept. That's where the term arises, and there's this long history. And that particularly in the 19th century, sovereignty was closely linked to, and this very much lines up with this rule of law stuff, to this sort of enchantment of reason. But what reason meant was an order that fit into a European world power structure. So, you know, like Anthony Angi's book about the 19th century sovereignty, you know, states are always being labeled as failing the basic foundations of sovereignty because they don't have the rule of law, and this then justifies European power. So I think that's very true, but I actually would resist this idea that sovereignty is a European or a Western concept. I mean, it is true that the word itself has this tradition, but this notion about the nature of power and about these different components that I was talking about at the beginning isn't by no means strictly European. You know, you find, as I said, under the Mughals, you find this, and this is a tradition which does not come from Europe. It comes from the Mongols, actually. And you find it in China, and you find it, I mean, many places. So in that sense, it seems to me a very useful comparative term if one approaches it that way. Now, on Iran, so Iran is a great case, and particularly when you're thinking about religion in the 20th century, you know, then I mean, it's interesting, again, Azfar Moin actually links the Mughals to the Safavids and talks about the ideas that are flowing back and forth between them, although that, of course, is going back to the 16th and 17th centuries. But I mean, the usual dichotomy when thinking about sovereignty is this rule of man, rule of law. And so you, for Iran, said, you know, well, there's tension between rule of man. Was it rule of God? Yeah. So. One could say this is a similar notion, but with an imagined power coming from elsewhere. So rule of law is rooted in this idea of the enchantment of reason, the ability to detach. And, I mean, of course, it's linked to scientific objectivity as well. And I mean, it's linked to academics, actually, to the development of universities. And rule of God then stands in for that. And though one might argue some of that is linked to the particular way that you know, God is seen to operate in human society, sort of. You know, in Iran, there's nothing parallel in India to the idea, you know, at least nothing parallel that has that profound an impact on politics to the idea of the, you know, the hidden imam
and having a you know, regents on Earth or whatever term you would want to use. So I think, yes, of course, Iran is different, but I think you could sort of analyze it in somewhat similar terms.
Well, go ahead and then thank you
for an interesting talk. I'm no expert on the subject, and so my eventual question will be quite tongue in cheek, but
but
you've made some quite interesting points about the facets of sovereignty, of the physical manifestations of power, and then this transcendent ideology, perhaps, to use my word, not yours, but. And this is related to the earlier question about Punjab. How does the horror and violence of the partition and the migrations between India and Pakistan relate to... How can the idea of sovereignty and rule of law be sustained for Pakistan when that sovereignty was broken down during the partition? And therefore, to put it almost another way, would we be having this lecture... were it not for the breakdown of law during partition?
Yeah, I mean, well, this is it's a great question, because this is the big issue about partition. You know, that it involved a kind of, and this is the way some people, not all, some people write about it, a kind of collapse of legitimate state authority. So it is, one could say in that context, a breakdown in sovereignty. That is, the vision of sovereignty that created Pakistan did not coincide with the state power that was available to the Pakistan state at the moment of partition in 1947, nor was that the case on the Indian side. And this came about because of the not dissolution of the state is too strong, but the significant undermining of the structure of state authority and the beliefs about state authority and the enchantment of the state and its sovereignty, which had existed. And so this is one way of looking at the violence. I wouldn't say everybody would take that view. That's precisely that breakdown that explains a lot of the violence that occurred. And certainly both India and Pakistan went to extraordinary lengths in the wake of that violence to try to kind of reassert claims to sovereignty in a variety of different ways. And a lot of people have written about this. So, you know, partly that involves really getting at why this isn't about the creation of Pakistan, but why it took the precise form it did, which is a completely separate question I haven't talked about. But to really answer your question, one would need to get into that a bit more.
Understood everything that you're saying correctly, well, I'm going to have a go.
Sure.
I was very interested, perhaps as a lawyer, in what you were saying about the rule of law and the idea that the British introduced, if you like, an ideology or a thinking about rule of law principles in order to achieve sovereignty. And I just wonder whether perhaps that's, not deliberately so, but perhaps if one looks at it objectively, maybe an over benign description, because what perhaps was more of a calculated decision overall, because the British were above all pragmatists, I feel, from my reading of Indian history, they recognised that the legitimacy they required was going to be a very important aspect of their plans for India. And their plans for India were very clear. They were going to map it. They were going to extract revenue from the exchequer back in the home country. There's a number of very pragmatic and distinct political economic plans that they have in India. And for those plans to be implemented, they weren't going to do it with a very large army. They never really had a very large army. They had to do it by embedding certain concepts.
Mm-hmm.
So the narrative, and I think you're right about this, the narrative that the British were very successful at, in parts, was a narrative that their decision-making was more rational and more rational and more reasoned,
mm-hmm.
because it drew its inspiration from rule of law principles.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that had traction as a narrative, in my view, I don't know if you agree with this, is that Indian society, at the time that the British came to India, already had very sophisticated systems of law in many of the communities that comprise India, and Islamic law is a classic example. Islamic law was already a very developed system of laws. The British in particular had no interest in wanting to get involved in arbitrating or being judicial arbiters of Muslim personal laws or Hindu personal laws. They didn't want to get involved in that. They were quite happy to leave that, as it were, to custom and to customary processes. And it seems to me that that narrative has some traction because there was a very sophisticated understanding of law and justice and fairness, and the British recognised that if they were able to embed that narrative, there would be a legitimacy that they would be able to say to the wider community, but also to those elites that were going to be involved, that what we're doing is for your own good as well.
Mm-hmm.
What we're doing is not just about us being rulers. And they knew they couldn't do it by saying, well, we've got kings and queens, and we're here on Queen Victoria's belt, because India had plenty of kings and queens and princes of their own, so that wasn't going to wash. Do you see what I'm...
Yeah, yeah.
I
yeah.
think what you're saying, I think you're right, but it seems to me that there's a very clear and distinct process to generate a narrative that gave that legitimacy, not because there was a desire to embed a respect for the primacy of the rule of law, or a desire to generate a wider discussion in Indian society that the reason that the rule of law is important is because it protects the rights of individuals as well as communities.
Yeah.
But it was a different, it was to create an ideological legitimacy for the bigger plan. And so they were content to leave those customary laws and personal laws and very sophisticated, you know, the Hanafi school of law.
Maybe we should let him answer.
So, again, what you're saying makes a lot of sense. I mean, but two things. I mean, one is the British did adjudicate Muslim law. There's this whole system of Anglo-Mohammedan law that they created, and you know, Anglo-Hindu law. And they did that for a reason. So it wasn't... They didn't want to just leave everything there. They wanted to incorporate it, but they did it in this way where they incorporated what they saw as the substance, which could be figured out from these texts, but without incorporating the procedure, because that was the realm they claimed. So I think that structure is quite important. I mean, the key thing I think you're getting at, and I don't know how one would get an answer to this, but, you know, were they pragmatic? You know, they didn't really believe in the rule of law, but they just thought this would be a good way, you know, to save some money on, you know, the military. So they did have a huge military, and they did use it plenty. And they used lots of violence, but they also spoke endlessly about this rule of law, and one can see the rule of law, you know, as completely hypocritical. That's why I said you should not confuse rule of law with the actual practice of law, although there of course is some connection. But I'm a little less willing to sort of say, oh, well, they didn't really believe in the rule of law, they just did this pragmatically, because, you know, that rhetoric is not peculiar to India. That you find that rhetoric here as well. And so I think a lot of them really believe this stuff, you know, for better or worse.
Any other questions? Okay, I'm going to ask my last question. The last question. You ended by saying that by taking this approach, one of the possibilities was to, you know, be able to write new histories. But going off Pakistan, and I see the argument you're making, but to go back to your answer to Professor Fuller's question, when you're thinking about new histories of Pakistan to be written, or the birth of Pakistan, the dichotomy between a new history of the birth of West Pakistan and, you know, the birth of what would eventually become Bangladesh several years later, you know, where I was curious about how, what you would say in answer to what, as an example of what was possibly a kind of new history that we could write if we took the motor of sovereignty as the driving force. The reason I make this point is that you refer to Asfar Moin several times, and yes, he makes this argument about sovereignty. The very title of his book, Millennial Sovereign, you know, the millennium is the millennium of Islam, which happens to fall in Akbar's reign.
Right.
And so the separation of religion from the concept of sovereignty, at least in Asfar's work, is, I can see what you're saying, but I can't see it as clearly in his work. So going forwards from there, you know, how would you, could you give an example of how you would imagine a history of the birth of Pakistan being written, taking both parts of Pakistan into account, you know, along the lines of sovereignty? Or any other example, because you ended with saying that we could imagine new histories.
Well, I mean, what I was thinking was, and I sort of said this at the beginning, and this is, you know, it's, I mean, thanks for your question, because, you know, this is a work in progress, I guess. But it is that it seems that this term religion has caused huge problems.
Because
it's used in very different sorts of ways. So it and this is a kind of modern phenomenon, and the and so when you're talking about questions like conscience and choice, and all this can be cast in a secular framework, as if it doesn't have to do with everyday religion, but yet it's deeply infused with religious ideas. This is where I'm, you know, a bit influenced by this work on what they call political theology, the idea that, you know, what looks secular is in fact shaped by theological ways of thinking about things. So, I mean, one of the things that happens with this, and this is what I was suggesting, is that, you know, Pakistan is this example of a country that's created in the name of this, you know, Muslim community, but nevertheless, the kind of dynamism behind the demand for Pakistan is very much shaped by this a vision of a kind of self-cultivation and self-control and dynamic commitment to ideals, which has as its flip side, maybe its dark side, you might say, this, you know, virtual contempt for the everyday religion of the people, which is quite intrinsic to it, and which incidentally you find across the board. I mean, this is not just so-called, you know, modernist elites, that you find this in the writings of the ulama, who are just contemptuous of, you know, common people. And custom is this term that's used over and over again. And so this was the notion, if we look at it this way, the what happens is not sort of this peculiar thing that, oh, it's about religion, so it's a throwback, and
Pakistan's been weird from the very beginning.
Yeah.
But rather that this tension between these different notions of sovereignty and custom actually would allow us to think about these things in different ways. So in that sense, you know, this absolutely, these same ideas are there when you get to, you know, like under Ayub Khan, the writing about East Bengali Muslims is this, you know, contemptuous notion that they're influenced by all these customary ideas. You know, they often say they're Hindu, but they don't have to be Hindu, you know, and that these elites are sort of, you know, they're the ones who have, it's, I mean, this is built into the rule of law. This idea that it's only people who have a kind of more fully developed, mature reasoning intellect can truly understand and deal with law and internalize it. Otherwise, law has to be a bludgeon to keep people in their place. So this is what I'm saying. If Pakistan would be actually a case that you could use to talk about lots of other parts of the world, which have these similar things going on, and it's not some weird case because it happens to have been, you know, based on religion. So that's the point I was trying to make.
Thank you. Sorry.
Yeah.
What I want to ask you, what are your thoughts on the fact that there's an inherent difference between saying Pakistan was made in the name of Islam and Pakistan was made for Muslims? Two completely different things. Because, you know, when I think Aisha Jalal's work, I found that when you say Pakistan was made in the name of Islam, one says, oh, that means, you know, it was based on the principles of Islam, Sharia law, and all of that.
Right.
But when you say Pakistan was made for Muslims, that just means it was made for a community that was deprived of its economics and political rights.
Yeah.
And I feel it's that distinction that many people, that many in Pakistan cannot make, which is why, you know, we have come to an existential crisis, or have been for a while. So I wanted to understand your thoughts on how that distinction plays into what you talk about religion and custom and sovereignty.
Yeah, I mean, thank you. That's I know that's, there's been a lot of arguing from that perspective, but from my perspective, I don't really buy that argument. And the reason is because this relates to what I was saying about Sharia, for example. So the commitment to Sharia, you know, you find across the board in Pakistan, if you're to, you know, if you ask people, do you believe in Sharia, should Muslims follow Sharia, you know, you would get, I don't know, but 90%, some huge number would say absolutely yes. So in that sense, it's all religion, but it's a completely different sense of what Sharia is. For some people, it just, I mean, to say Sharia means you should be moral. You know, it doesn't mean anything more than that. And as I was saying, you see this in the Pakistan movement itself. I mean, this is a lot of the ambiguity about whether Jinnah supported Sharia. This is, yeah, Jinnah, the way, it's like the way Iqbal supported Sharia. You can find this, but it wasn't that he supported, you know, that the ulama should, you know, practice traditions of fiqh. It's just, it comes to stand in for something. So I don't think most people would buy the distinction that, oh, this is culture and this is religion. So I'm a little hesitant about that. But I do think you can make this argument, as I was saying, I mean, about a kind of, you know, claim to sovereign authority. And that very much comes out of a particular orientation, which is deeply shaped by the structure of British rule.
Thank you very much.